couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films John Wick Chapter 4, Agent Elvis, Most Dangerous Game New York, Still Working 9 to 5, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. A look back at that little gem. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Miracle Workers. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Now, the big news this week was the box office, not as much as the numbers of the box office, but the blowback on the box office. Shazam! Fury of the Gods made $31.1 million, and that was enough to put it in first place, but it kind of flopped into first place because that's not a great showing. I mean, Scream 6 dropped like 60-some percent, and it still had like 17 million. That was number two, and then Creed, and then 65, and then Ant-Man and the Wasp. But with only Shazam! Fury of the Gods as the big opening weekend, it should have had a lot better. To put it in perspective, the first Shazam made like 53 million its opening weekend. And this movie costs like 25% more to make. And it dropped almost half. That's not a good number. That is not a good number for a movie you spend $125 million on. Then something very interesting happened. The blame game started. The director, David F. Sandberg, started posting some things on Twitter, and I'm pretty sure he was posting these. You know, a lot of celebrities, they'll a lot of times have a social media manager who will take care of that for them and post on their behalf, but I'm pretty sure that he was actually out there tweeting on it because he was sort of conversational about it. And the first thing he did was get upset. Because, oh, come on, people, go see my movie. And then he was saying, well, I'm this is why I'm quitting superhero movies. I'm not doing any more superhero movies because I'm tired of the discourse. Everybody's out there as a hater. And he talked about how it's the lowest Rotten Tomatoes score and the highest audience score on Rotten Tomatoes simultaneously in his career. He's only had four movies and two of them were Shazam films. The other two were horror films, which ratings and responses are kind of different in that genre compared to just sort of mainstream stuff. And then Rachel Zegler, who played one of the three daughters of Atlas in the movie, she posted, and I don't even know if she posted. This might have come from a social media manager because it had like four pictures that were chosen. And so it felt a little bit more like a canned response or she maybe consulted with it, but somebody else was posting for her. I don't know. But she essentially called the people who were criticizing it mean-spirited. Oh, these mean-spirited. And then she says something like, it's just cool to hate on fun now. And that's what people tend to rally behind a movie like this when it gets middling reviews. They're like, oh, but it's just fun. It's good old-fashioned entertainment. Part of the thing is stars are required contractually to promote their movies everywhere they go, whether they're appearing on late-night TV with Fallon or Seth Meyers, or if they're doing it on social media. But the problem is, I don't think they provide as much context of how you respond online. And that can be very dicey, especially for somebody who acts for a living or directs for a living and doesn't engage in the public directly like that and isn't like a spokesperson, so to speak. And you're kind of just leaving it up to them. And so one of the things I always tell people, don't answer your critics. Don't respond to your critics like that. It just makes you look petty. Just let it go because you're not going to make more people go. You're not going to change people's mind with a tweet like that. Then I don't know who it was, whether it was the studio or whether it was somebody in marketing or whether it was just somebody off the cuff, threw Dwayne Johnson under the bus and was saying, well, there was supposed to be a Shazam cameo in Black Adam, but Dwayne Johnson nixed that. And then there were ideas of how to tie it in there. But see, Dwayne Johnson wanted to fight Superman, even though Shazam and Black Adam come from the same. They both have a lightning bolt and they both say Shazam. For crying out loud, you don't even have to know the comics to know they're related. I mean, Shazam, the wizard, shows up in both movies. But Dwayne Johnson didn't want to fight Zachary Levi. He wanted to fight Henry Cavill. And so he sort of wrestled control. And that shows the chaos that goes behind some of these Warner Brothers. I'm talking about pre-Gunn. I don't know if anything that James Gunn is doing after this is going to be affected by it. But this is all how Warner Brothers put it together. You know what you never see? You never see the Marvel actors start lashing out at their co-stars publicly on Twitter, because I guarantee you Disney, I'm sure Marvel Entertainment controlled what they could say and how they could say it earlier, but Disney certainly does. I just, that's how Disney operates. Like, you didn't see Chloe Zhao come out and start blaming Angelina Jolie for Eternals or something like that, because that one was not as well received. Eternals didn't do terribly well, but people didn't start fighting on Twitter from the cast and crew of that. And then it just moved on, and then we had some other superhero movies. It's interesting watching the behind the scenes of this because of the people throwing each other under the bus. And the fact that Zachary Levi and Dwayne Johnson now are beefing online, even if it's just sort of subtweeting, it's not a good look. And there's many reasons why Shazam Fury of the Gods bombed. Part of it was because it wasn't as good of a movie, that flat out. And it just didn't drag people to the theaters. And there's elements to it. You know, the presentation of Shazam is a really weird, goofy character that people didn't like that. People don't want to see a movie from the old canon. I don't know if that has a huge effect on it, but, you know, as we're knowing all this stuff is coming up, it'll be interesting to see how well these DC movies perform this year that aren't looking forward. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to look at is You Hurt My Feelings, which is coming to theaters on May 26th.
So, Elliot tells me you're a writer.
And your last one, it should have done better.
There's lots of new voices. Refugees, cancer, murder, abuse.
I'm an old voice.
You're the best voice.
Maybe if Dad hadn't just been verbally abusive, it would have been a bestseller.
He's been lying to me this whole time.
I wasn't lying. I was encouraging.
That's not true. You were lying to be encouraging.
You know what? As an actor, Mark isn't always great.
So the times when you don't think he's good, what do you say to him?
You are so fantastic.
Really?
This one stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus. It's been a while since we've had her headlining a movie. She actually had a big push a couple of years ago. She wasn't doing her own TV shows anymore. I think Veep was wrapping up. But this looks like it's going to be funny, because the story is essentially, it's about when people tell white lies to each other. They're like, no, you look great when you really don't. Or, oh, you're so good at doing what you do when you're not. You're being supportive as a family member or a loved one, but you are sometimes not being truthful to them, and it examines that. And I think that's an interesting thing to examine in society. It'll be really interesting to see how the people making this movie present this to the mainstream, because it could go either way. It could go very warm and understanding and be like, oh, everybody does that. And it could also turn into something where more normal people look at this and say, well, you're kind of a monster if you do this. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken. It comes to theaters on June 30th.
I'm just Ruby Gilman, normal teenager.
For generations, Krakens have protected the seas, keeping us safe from the most power-hungry and dangerous creature of all.
The mermaid?
Yes!
But people love mermaids.
I love you so much!
Love you too, Rando!
Of course they do!
Are you okay?
I know your secret. You're a Kraken hiding as a human.
I really gotta go.
Oh, no.
And soon, everyone will know the truth.
It looks fun. It looks clever and cute. I don't know if this is based on any original source material, but it certainly is a unique and different movie. I mean, maybe a little bit of connective tissue with something like Luca, which is from a different studio. And the design of this looks a lot like the Trolls design. But it looks like it's a fun little movie of teenage discovery and this girl who's a Kraken and trying to hide in school. And then, of course, the mermaid is, oh, everyone loves mermaids. Well, no, they're really the villain. And so it kind of has that Mean Girls angle to it. It looks cute. It looks sweet. I'm hoping that it leans into the weirdness of being a teenager, which was kind of like that movie Vivo on Netflix. It was an animated film about a kinkachu. And that had a real love for weirdness and dorkiness. And it sort of said, hey, you know, if you're strange, that's okay. It's okay to be strange and to be a kid. Because we don't always get that message in movies. So I'll be curious to see this one. It looks cute. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be looking at The Most Dangerous Game, New York, and Still Working 9 to 5. The This is a public service announcement. Manscaped now has beard products, and it's going even further with their brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. Go ahead and tell the world the leaders in below-the-line waist grooming are traveling north of your South Pole with their revolutionary grooming products. The new Weed Whacker 2.0 and their new beard line confirms that they have the best tools for your hygiene toolbox. Time for you to upgrade your game by going to manscaped.com and using our code FATGUYS for 20% off and free shipping. There's a lot of good stuff in here. You've got a beard trimmer with 20 different hair cutting lengths. You've got beard shampoo and conditioner and beard oil and beard balm all in this Beard Hedger Pro Kit. It gives you everything you need to trim everything nice. And then on top of it, you get all the little small parts, the nose hairs and the ears hair. Let's face it, hair is a great thing to have, but hair in some places is not. So check out the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0 with improved blades and skin-safe technology. Get 20% off and free shipping with our code FATGUYS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use our code FATGUYS. Always use the right tool for the right job with Manscaped. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews and talk about Most Dangerous Game, New York. It was originally a Quibi production, and it starred Christoph Waltz and Liam Hemsworth, and it was an update of the Most Dangerous Game story. They've done it multiple times. And if you recall the way Quibi worked is they were short, like 10-minute episodes. They break it into just 12 10-minute segments, so you'd have a two-hour movie. And that's what the Most Dangerous Game was initially. And after Quibi flopped and went bankrupt, Roku bought their content. And every now and then I'll pop into Roku and look at the Quibi content, because content wasn't bad, and I covered a couple of the movies a couple of years ago. But then I was just on Roku, and I noticed, oh my gosh, I got a new series. They did a second season of this. I think it came out 2 weeks ago, so I'm a little late on it, but I didn't even know it was existing. And so I thought, oh, let me cover that. That's interesting. So I went ahead and I watched it. So in this new one, Most Dangerous Game New York, the second season of the original Quibi series finds a new runner trying to survive being hunted over 24 hours.
Beautiful day for a game.
I give you Victor Suero. He will provide a level of competition we've never seen before.
So you are going to get me my money. I don't care how or your beautiful little sister Josie suffers.
I read up on you a little bit. That's how I knew that I could help you.
What is this?
A hunt to kill.
A hunt is 24 hours.
Anyone you run into could be the last person you ever see.
Here's the thing. Nick Santora is the guy who runs this show, and he's done a bunch of stuff like Prison Breaks and Breakout Kings. His stuff tends to be very machismo. It's that I want to be an action movie, but I'm on TV type of feeling. And so there's a lot of bluster and puffing your chest out in these series. And to me, that's always been the negative side of Nick Santora's projects. It pushes that overblown masculinity. There's no subtlety to a lot of their stuff. And I like the more intellectual side of it. So you would get the big, strong, punchy guys in stuff like Prison Break, but there was also an intellectual side to Prison Break that I liked. But you do get a lot of that in this new version of The Most Dangerous Game, even more so than the last one, because you had Liam Hemsworth as the star. I don't even know who the guy is who plays the runner in this one. It seems somewhat of a generic, we got a prize fighter to throw a match, and he owes all this money. Christoph Waltz still plays a good job. I think Christoph Waltz could make an entire late career in playing dark and seedy businessmen who try and do nefarious things. Because I thought he's the best part of these two seasons. He's the best part of that series, The Consultant, on Hulu. I like this version of Christoph Waltz. So he's fun to watch. You got Anna Gunn from Breaking Bad playing sort of like the head of the organization. And it's nice to see her in a part you're supposed to hate. Because everyone hated Skyler in Breaking Bad, but she was trying to be a sympathetic character. But this one, she's not. And so, but it falls into those tropes of television where it's this massive cabal of evildoers who are controlling things, and sort of like the Hostel films where everybody who's a billionaire gets to bid on stuff. And there's no subtlety to it, but it's not a bad little throwaway show. The biggest problem is the main character is just, he's okay. Not that Liam Hemsworth was some great dynamo of acting and empathy, but I felt he was more identifiable. But still, you know, if you're looking for just something mindless to watch on a Friday night as you're getting ready to go to bed, yeah, The Most Dangerous Game New York works. I mean, it's overloaded with TV action series machismo, but it offers a passable shortcut adventure. I'm going to have to say Most Dangerous Game New York kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Still Working 9-to-5. And I rarely do this. It's a film that is currently in festivals and should be, I've been told, should be getting a distribution situation soon. So it's not available to see unless you go to whatever festival it is. But I found it intriguing and I had time to cover it and I got a screener. So I watched it. This documentary looks back at the groundbreaking film 9-to-5 and how things have progressed or not over the past 40 years.
I didn't like some of the humor in the 9-to-5 script, so I turned it down.
I got some flack working with Jane, being such a radical gal.
Women work because they have to, and they're getting angry, and they're beginning to organize all around the country, and I support them, and I'm going to make a movie.
Everybody was very nervous about the movie because it was three female leads.
The core message in 9-to-5 was, you deserve better.
Women said, I'm not going to take it anymore.
All of those things about 9-to-5, women are still fighting for.
What intrigued me about this movie is I remember when this film came out, I was 9. It was a massive phenomenon. And I saw it as a 9-year-old and I enjoyed it. And I was looking at it from a weird perspective because as a 9-year-old, I was looking at it as a kid who stayed home with his mom. I mean, I went to school and stuff, but my mom was a stay-at-home mom, at least at the beginning of my life. You know, when I got to be a teenager, she ended up getting a job outside of the house because we could take care of ourselves. But, you know, she was a stay-at-home mom. I saw the perspective as a child through the women's eyes. And at that age, I didn't care about politics. I didn't care about working politics and feminism and anything like that. I remember seeing the movie and thinking it was hilarious. And there's a lot of stuff I didn't get. And then later on, I saw it as an adult. And I'm like, oh, all this stuff flew over my head as a kid. But it's still a great movie and it moves and it's a great little film. And so I think it's interesting looking back on. So I like retrospectives of a movie, especially something that had an impact on culture and had an impact on society. It's neat looking back on this. And, you know, as a kid, not knowing anything about Jane Fonda, even though she was the spearhead to this movie and the documentary follows her determination to get it made. And it's a well-made movie. I think it does a good job balancing between looking back on the movie and how it was made and the struggles that it faced. And then the back half of it is more about what's going on in gender politics in the workplace now. And I think those are two somewhat separate discussions, but they are connected. And certainly the retrospective of the film and is great. And for example, they got Dabney Coleman interviewed in the film and most people remember him from all those acerbic characters he always played. But you forget that he was not the characters he played. He was an actor and a person. So hearing his perspective on playing Mr. Hart was very interesting. Of course, learning how the women got involved in doing it, everyone from Dolly Parton to Lily Tomlin. And forgetting now, you know, that Lily Tomlin, she's much older and forgetting that she was just sort of the average housewife at the time. It's a neat retrospective on the film and it tells you some stuff I never knew about it. And then looking forward to workplace politics now, it's so easy when you're mired in the situation to say, that's not what's really going on. But then you can remove yourself 40 years and look back at the stuff that they're poking fun at in this film that seemed normal and everyday is shocking now to look at just the rampant sexism and favoritism that did go on and still goes on. Favoritism does not only go after gender politics, but it does show that there are still issues that people are facing. You're still looking at pay gap. And at times, it's funny, it's moved a little bit outside of the gender politics and more into class politics, especially when they address the gig economy. But I think it zeroes in on the points that were discussed in the movie. So yeah, it's a good look back. I mean, it's a strong retrospective of the politics behind 9-to-5 and a look at modern problems in the workplace. I'm going to say that Still Working 9-to-5 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about John Wick Chapter 4 and Agent Elvis. Working 9 to 5, what a way. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. And let's talk about the big movie of the weekend, the one that is very explosive and very violent, and that is John Wick Chapter 4. Everyone is still trying to kill John Wick, and he is still trying to win his freedom, and a lot of people die.
A new day is dawning. New ideas, new rules, new management.
Who is this?
The Marquis de Grammont.
Challenge him to single combat. Win or lose, it's a way out.
I don't sit at the table.
Your family does.
I'm going to need a gun.
If you win, the table will honor its word.
The John Wick movies are fascinating to me because they are easily the most successful franchise Keanu Reeves has ever starred in. Yes, he had The Matrix. But if you recall, The Matrix had its ups and downs. The first film was a huge hit, and the second film did very well, but had mixed reviews, and then the third film went down, and then they did the reboot a couple years ago, which I personally really enjoyed, but it kind of flopped. This series started out as a $20 million action film. Kind of was done on the cheap, and I don't even think it made $100 million worldwide. But then they did the next movie and they increased the budget and did better. And they did the next movie, increased the budget, and it did better. And this one, they've increased the budget and it's probably going to do better. It is now a huge movie. And that's a strange trajectory. That is unheard of for a movie to just build and build and build. Usually by the time you get to the third film in a franchise that wasn't planned to be a franchise, it'll start wobbling. But this series has doubled down and been very successful doing it. And if you look at some of the numbers, early numbers for the weekend, this is going to also be a monster hit. I think what makes this series work is its simplicity. It's not trying to be anything beyond the basic story of a guy trying to get out and the organization pulling him back in. He just wants to be left alone. But they won't. Now, I'll just talk about the things that work against the movie. It is almost 3 hours. And there's really no excuse for that in this day and age. I mean, it's a John Wick movie. There's not much of a story there. You don't need it to be 3 hours, but it does draw itself out like a spaghetti western. It feels like it's trying to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's okay. I get what they're doing, but they do let it breathe a little bit too much. There's no reason. It does not need to be that long. And I heard that the original cut was like 4 hours, and I'm like, holy cow, there's no reason for that. Now, with that said, it's probably the most efficient 3-hour action movie I've seen. Usually when I go to a movie and it's 3 hours or close or 2.5 hours plus, I'm rolling my eyes and checking my watch and, you know, and this doesn't make you do it. The first time I looked at my watch, I'm like, oh, we're an hour into this movie. It really moves. It doesn't slag, but it really could have been shorter. The other thing, and this is related to that, the other thing that has a problem there is it really leans into the mythology of it. In the original movie, it was just he was part of this unknown international cabal of assassins, but then the bad guys came after him. In this movie, they really lean into that. They lean into that backstory, and they kind of use that to justify the 3-hour running time. And it's a little bit absurd. This international cabal where they have control of everything. And there's no police in this movie anywhere. There's a scene in there where, they shoot up everywhere in Paris. It's this massive destruction throughout the city of Paris. Not one cop car. That's just something you have to accept. It's like the cartoony violence. I mean, the violence is over the top. And it's not even equitable violence. Like, for example, there's a scene where he kills somebody by basically throwing him off a balcony and he lands on his head on these stairs. And you know, it's just a flight of stairs. And that kills this guy, but John Wick literally falls off of like a 6-story building and lands on a van. And he just kind of, that hurt a little bit. And I'm like, dude, you almost have an AARP card. You're like 58. I broke my rib slipping on the ice outside my house one day. So, you know, the human body doesn't take that kind of punishment. But, I mean, it's Looney Tunes type violence. It's over the top and ridiculous. But what makes a movie good is it delivers exactly what you want. It's got a great cast like Donnie Yen, Ian McShane, Lawrence Fishburne. You got Bill Skarsgård as the bad guy, and he's fantastic. He's, of course, people know him as Pennywise from the It movies. But also, it looks fantastic. It's got these international location, and they use every ounce of that. They use every drop of the international locations. It's got locations and settings that would make a James Bond film jealous. And it's so well lit. It's a beautiful looking movie. It's got some of the best cinematography I've seen all year. And it's so refreshing to see a film where somebody's got the light on their face. So many movies now, you put somebody in shadow and they have everything lit behind them, and then you can barely see their expression. That's the trend now, because that looks real. But I'm like, light the faces, light the people, and you can see what's going on. You can see everything happening in the film, and that's refreshing, and it looks so good. So it's beautifully shot with excellent action, though a little long and leaning too much into the mythology. But overall, John Wick Chapter 4 gives you exactly what you want. The fans are going to love it. I think the casual viewer, I mean, if you hate action movies, you won't. But I mean, just the average viewer saying, oh, yeah, I'll go see an action movie, you can follow it and enjoy it. So, yeah, I'm going to have to say John Wick Chapter 4 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Agent Elvis. I previewed this in the trailer park a couple weeks ago. I wanted to cover it. It's on Netflix, an animated series. In the early 1970s, rock and roll superstar Elvis Presley and his perverse chimpanzee sidekick become government agents.
Who are you people, and what is all this?
The chance to weaponize rock and roll.
Time for Elvis to become an agent.
Viva Las Vegas!
I'm not stealing from the president.
It's not stealing if it's not his. Same way, it's not murder if you do it with your eyes closed. Now go!
Loving the weird energy right now.
Bright lights, city, gonna set my
kick-ass spy gadgets.
Set my soul on fire.
Insanely dangerous.
I guarantee a very abrupt, violent death.
I was intrigued by this when it first had the trailer drop a couple weeks ago. Because it has Matthew McConaughey playing Elvis, which is interesting. And, like, Priscilla Presley is a producer on there. I think she actually plays herself, voices her own character. And it's got your average guest stars from comedy. You've got people like Caitlin Olsen has a role in there. And you've got Jason Mendoza shows up at one point as Howard Hughes. So it does follow the modern comedy casting route. But as interesting as the idea and as fun as the idea could be, it just felt empty. And like part of it is, it's sort of like somebody went to the Wikipedia entry for Elvis and said, okay, we have to reference all these things. And it just seemed forced. I didn't watch all the series. I was like 10 episodes. I only watched a couple. It just wasn't funny. It's a great premise. It's an elevator pitch type show. But a lot of the jokes just don't land. I mean, the animation's really good. It's this stylized, bright, and vibrant animation. I'm gonna use it as an example, a fart joke, okay? I'm not saying that this does them, but, you know, classic fart jokes in comedy. You've got the campfire scene in Blazing Saddles. That is a funny fart joke scene. And there's other films that have great jokes like that. The Naked Gun does some great ones. But just putting a fart in a movie doesn't make it funny. We've seen enough kids' movies where they have a and you're like, oh, isn't that supposed to be? And yeah, it'll make a 5-year-old laugh. I used to say to my kids, no, you can't just make a joke. You can't just make a sound or a reference. It has to be funny and it has to be relevant. You can't just throw it out there. And it was funny because my son, just years ago, my oldest son was on the phone with his girlfriend. And my youngest son, he was kind of a little kid then, he comes in and he fart noises. And I yell, I go, hey, what did I tell you? And the girlfriend's listening on the phone and she's like, oh, he's going to yell at him. I go, no, if you're going to make a joke like that, it's got to be funny and it's got to be relevant. And my son's girlfriend on the phone broke up laughing because she was like, she wasn't expecting me to school him on making a joke. She thought I was just going to yell him for making fun of body sounds. And that's kind of the easy jokes that Agent Elvis goes for. And they're all like based on pop culture and historical stuff that kind of swirled around Elvis, but there's no soul to it. You know, despite stylized and flashy animation, this plays off old jokes and awkward, outdated pop culture references rather than telling a fun and hilarious story. I'm going to have to say Agent Elvis kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we've got a look back at Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Miracle Workers.
Oh, oh, I love you so. Oh, I can't let you go.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and finish up with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. This is a look back at the Indiana Jones movies. I've been doing this for the first three. I did the first three a couple weeks ago. And now I am talking about the Indiana Jones reboot from 2008. I was actually doing the show 15 years ago when that movie came out. And you can go back in the archives and find my original thoughts on it. But this is a look back 15 years later. 15 years. Isn't that terrifying that they're making another Indiana Jones movie with Harrison Ford 15 years later? They're like literally going to reanimate his corpse for the next film, I think. But anyways, more than a decade after his last adventure, swashbuckling archaeologist Indiana Jones is pulled into the field to investigate a lost city of gold.
Legend says that a crystal skull was stolen from a mythical lost city in the Amazon. Supposedly built out of solid gold, guarded by the living dead. Whoever returns the skull to the city temple will be given control over its power.
You will help us find it.
This was a highly anticipated film. My wife was pregnant with my third son at the time. And I was on my way to go to an out-of-town early screening of Iron Man, the original Iron Man. And I got a call from my wife, and I answered my phone. She's like, okay, I'm at the gynecologist, and we have to set up when we're going to do our C-section. And so I said, just to make sure it doesn't interfere with the screening for the new Indiana Jones movie. And my son's, you know, he's going to be turning 15 this year. So that's how long ago this movie came out. And I was a huge Indiana Jones fan as a kid. I loved the first three movies. I even liked Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. You can go back a couple weeks ago and listen to my response to it. Then this new movie came out, and this is the bear trap you can step into when you make a movie with essentially all the same people 20 years later, because the last Indiana Jones movie had come out in 1989, and this one came out in 2008. So it was almost 20 years after the last indie film. People get old. People get old. Time passes. And so Harrison Ford was not the guy in his, 40s at the time he did Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? And there's nothing wrong with that. And one of the things people just dumped on this film because they're like, oh, it's stupid aliens, because it had sort of this alien subplot to it. And they're like, oh, it used too much CGI. The only complaint that was universally had about this movie that I agree with is Mutt being played by Shia LaBeouf. I do not think he worked in the movie. At the time, Shia LaBeouf was the it guy. He was in the Transformers films. He was doing a bunch of stuff at the time. And I thought he was awful. I don't think he was good for the movie. But all the changes they made, Spielberg realized, he's like, well, I'm not going to jump 20 years in the future. I'll go about 10. Because obviously Indiana Jones is older. And it fits with what 50s movies were. You know, back in the 30s and early 40s, which is where the original Indiana Jones movies took place, those were all about jungle adventures and hidden temples and using, you know, sort of like going to find religious artifacts. By the time you got to the 50s, the serials and the pulpy movies and the Saturday matinees were about aliens. And they were existing in the 50s, and so you have to realize this was post-World War II. You couldn't make the Nazis the bad guys. The Russians were the bad guys, because they were the bad guys in the 50s. They should still be the bad guys now. And they are. But with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, it tips its hat at all of this 50s stuff going on. The Better Dead Than Red protests that were going on in the 50s at the time. The styles, the clothes the kids were wearing, the greasers and the diners and all this stuff, the rock and roll music. This was stuff that permeates the film. And a lot of people were set off by that because they wanted the original Indiana Jones, which was 30s and 40s. But Indiana Jones is older. You couldn't make him young again. I think this is going to play into this Dial of Destiny movie because, again, you can't just make a movie where Indiana Jones is 35 years old anymore. And so I thought that that was fair. I thought that that made it work. And yes, did they use CGI? Yes. Why? Because in 2008, CGI was standard procedure. Back in 1989, CGI was just starting out and they didn't really use it for, they may have used part of it. But I mean, all the people said, oh, nuke the fridge. It's so stupid and unplausible. Have you seen some of the stuff that happened in the other Indiana Jones? They parachute out of an airplane in a life raft in the second film. And don't tell me that the special effects were 100% perfect because there were some really goofy opticals. The bridge sequence in Temple of Doom has some really goofy opticals. And if you sit there and talk about, you know, the characters, but yeah, because they grew and they were different. I still found it to be a fun movie. Like I said, I wasn't a big fan of Shia LaBeouf. I think that was a mistake. And I didn't want to see him take over the franchise and nobody else did, so that's why I didn't. But I still like this movie. It's still fun to watch. It's not the same, but it wasn't made in the 80s. It was made 20 years later. You can't, it's not going to be the same. People got to realize you can have a throwback and not be exactly the same. You take something, what's going on Star Trek right now, with Star Trek Picard, that's absolutely a throwback to the Next Generation. But it's been updated with the characters, and they allowed them to get older. So, look, this was much maligned by fans, but it's a decent update of Indiana Jones from the 1950s. I gotta say, I still think it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Miracle Workers, which is a comedy series which aired on TBS. I think they've done 4 seasons of it. I've watched 2 of them. This anthology series starts with a look at workers in the answered prayer department of Heaven, Inc., trying to save Earth from destruction.
I am transferring you to the Department of Answered Prayers. I'm Eliza.
I'm Craig. Welcome to Answered Prayers. You have arrived just in time.
2 billion prayers received.
We have to answer all those prayers?
I generally try and shoot for 3-4 a day. Although, now that I've got you, a teammate, there's no telling what we can do.
Please, God, we need your help. Earth is in big trouble. It is a mess.
We need a miracle.
So I've decided to blow up Earth.
Like I said, this was on TBS, but I watched it on HBO Max. I kind of stumbled into it. It stars Daniel Radcliffe. He's sort of one of the big names in it. And they've got people like Steve Buscemi in it, recognizable names. And it's an anthology series. I didn't know that going in. I thought that that's what it was all about. So the first season starts out in this Heaven Incorporated realm. And we've seen stuff like this before, but it's a clever little idea where the people working behind the scenes to make heaven work. And it's sort of like a modern office place. And you have all the problems that you would on a modern office. And Steve Buscemi plays God, and God is sort of this absentee God, and he's given people free will. So of course we're making a mess of things. And ultimately he's ready to blow up the planet because he's just ready to get the experiment over. But these two workers are trying to save everything. And I thought it was a neat, clever idea. I mean, like I said, I've seen stuff like this before, but I thought it was fresh enough. And it resolves to a certain point at the end of the first season. And then I said, well, I'll go on to the next season. I didn't know it was an anthology. And then it starts doing this thing in the Dark Ages where you have all the characters, all the actors are playing different characters. And I thought that it was going to be connected. I thought they're going to get 3 or 4 episodes in and suddenly realize, oh yeah, the guy who shovels poop out of your homes is actually God. And somehow he got relegated down onto the planet. But that's not the point. It was a whole nother story just with the whole cast doing another story. And it wasn't connected to it. That's, I think, my biggest problem with this series is it wasn't even the same connective tissue. The first season was this very heady, what if God ran creation like The Office? And then this other one was, oh, it's just a story of some weird people in the Dark Ages trying to get through their lives. And the fact that there wasn't any payoff in that respect, it was disappointing. The second season is funny, and it has its moments, but it's not like the first season. And the first season clicked so much better, and so I'm not like exactly running out to watch the next two seasons. It's one of those things where you cobbled yourself. You know, like when they did American Horror Story, even though I didn't particularly like that series, you know, the first season did its story, and then they rebooted it with a lot of the same cast, and you're like, oh, it's another horror story. There's no connective tissue to this, and even the term miracle workers doesn't fit for the second season, and that's my biggest problem. I mean, season one was a banger, but the reset with the same cast loses the overall freshness that launched the show. So I loved season one. I thought it was very fun and cool and heady. I was sort of meh on season two, and I don't know if I want to continue to the next one. So I'll still say it kind of rocks because the first season was good, but it was disappointing as it moves on.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for the show. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, and until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.